And welcome to tonight's forum on fake news and the demise of civil discourse. I'm Renee Bodley, the general manager of KPCW and the moderator of this evening's panel. We will air this forum in its entirety on KPCW, which is 91.7 in Summit County, 91.9 and 88.1 in Heber City and Wasatch County and parts of Summit County. We're also streaming this forum live on our website, kpcw.org. We're broadcasting from St. Luke's Episcopal Church in Park City. I'd like to welcome the audience here and our listeners on the airwaves and online, wherever you are. Tonight's broadcast is presented by the Park City Area Project for Deeper Understanding. The project is a team of citizens dedicated to creating events in which people with differing perspectives on important issues can meet for respectful dialogue and information sharing. Our mission is to educate the public as we fight cultural polarization and misunderstanding. The Reverend Charles Robinson explained the structure and ground rules for this evening to our panel and audience just a few minutes ago. Let's get started. Fake news is getting many headlines these days. Congressional committees are looking into allegations that foreign countries are planting false stories on the internet to influence American public policy. On Monday, Facebook handed congressional investigators 3,000 ads that had been purchased by Russian government affiliates during the 2016 campaign season. Misinformation about the mass shooting in Las Vegas is still spreading online. Was the shooter a recent Islamic convert, a Rachel Maddow fan, or a plant to establish new gun control laws? All of that is online right now. Just yesterday, the President of the United States tweeted, "Wow, so many fake news stories today. No matter what I do or say, they will not write or speak truth. The fake news media is out of control!" Exclamation mark. On our panel tonight are experienced journalists, a media manager, a media scholar, a First Amendment attorney, and a cybersecurity expert who's running a little bit late. He'll join us in about 10 minutes. Each panelist will have a few moments to introduce themselves. Stu Stanek, we'll start with you.
I'm Stu Stanek. I'm regional president for iHeartRadio and iHeartMedia across United States. Specifically, I handle some radio stations, manage radio stations here in Salt Lake. I also take care of El Paso, Texas, New Mexico, and Honolulu, Hawaii. So we have 36 stations in my little group all together. We're part of an 850 station group, number one reach medium in the entire country. So proud to be here. I think it's an excellent topic, and there's a lot of great people on the panel. I hope everybody enjoys it.
We're looking forward to hearing your perspective as someone who really sees media from a 30,000-foot level. 36 is not small, by the way.
Maybe 32.
George Pyle.
Yes, I'm George Pyle. I'm the editorial page editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. I've been in the newspaper business for longer than I might like to think about. It's been about 40 years now. Since about 2002 at the Tribune, on the editorial page staff, first as a writer and just recently became editorial page editor. I've been following all these issues for a very long time. This is also the third panel about fake news that I've been invited to take part in, and I'm starting to get a little worried about every time somebody says fake news, they think of me. So, I'm hoping that means that people think I'm discerning enough to be able to tell the difference. We'll see.
Don't take it personally, George. Ben Winslow.
My name is Ben Winslow. I'm a reporter for Fox 13 in Salt Lake City. I've been doing journalism for about, 20 years now. I started at a small radio station in southern Utah and then moved up to Salt Lake City. I've worked for the Salt Lake Tribune, KSL, the Deseret News, and now Fox. Fake news is something that is bantered about quite a bit, and I kind of see it from a number of different ways. So I'm really looking forward to this discussion. It should be very interesting.
Thank you, Ben. Marcia Maxwell.
Thanks for having me. I'm Marcia Maxwell. I'm a PhD student in the Department of Communication and also the Department of Writing and Rhetoric Studies at the University of Utah. I teach writing classes at the university. I have a background in journalism, and so I've written for several local newspapers and magazines. In my graduate studies, I look at controversial issues and how they are discussed in the public arena, so that includes journalism. It includes social media, also public comments, and public hearings, and I look at who's speaking out, what kind of arguments are they making, and how do those ultimately affect decision-making processes. So I look at news and fake news as a scholar, as a practitioner, and also as a teacher.
Thank you. Hi, John.
Hi, I'm John Mejia. I am the legal director of the ACLU of Utah, and I've been there about 7 years now. Before that, I worked in the courts and was a practicing attorney. The ACLU, our mission, we're a nonprofit, and our mission is to expand and protect individual and civil liberties for everybody in Utah. My main role as legal director is to bring lawsuits when necessary against the government when they cross the line regarding any civil right, and I have brought several First Amendment cases against various governments in Utah. So, experienced litigating these issues, and I've done a lot of thinking about the First Amendment, and am interested to hear how other perspectives about fake news as well.
And Robert Huber, you met the deadline. Welcome.
I got some fake news that said we weren't starting until 7:30, so I thought I was on time. So I have about 20 years of operational cybersecurity experience. I'm currently Chief Security and Strategy Officer for East One Networks, a cyber startup in Salt Lake City. I've done everything from build security operations centers for JP Morgan Chase, Lockheed Martin, built and sold my own cybersecurity company. I'm also a member of the Air National Guard. I'm a cyberspace operations officer. In that role, I conduct offensive and defensive cyber operations. What that means is sometimes maybe we generate fake news. I'm not going to say we do or don't, but to achieve effects, that's one of the weapons in our cadre, as you can imagine. So should be an interesting conversation tonight.
Wow, that's a good way to kick off. Let's start with the big question that's on everyone's mind. What is fake news, and how is it different from professional journalism? Stu, we'll start with you.
Well, until November, I thought I had a good definition for it, and it is somebody who is purposely writing something that is designed to be from the onset untrue and is designed for a purpose of either spreading misinformation or making a profit. I think that the discussion about fake news right now is very different. I don't think fake news is defined as something that doesn't make a particular politician unhappy. Fake news is something that is blatantly false and has a disregard for the truth. So I think everybody might disagree on that on some level, but a fake news story about being able to buy medical marijuana or marijuana in Colorado with food stamps started fake. It was intended to be fake, and it made the writer a lot of money. To me, that's the purest definition of fake news, and that was its origin.
That someone's doing it for capital gain?
Absolutely. That guy's running a website, clearing $20,000 to $30,000 a month. As he started telling the story about this fake news story, he could hardly contain himself from laughing, believing that people could hardly be that gullible and buy into that.
So George Pyle, I think our commander-in-chief probably has a different idea about what fake news is.
Well, yeah, I think it's pretty obvious that when the president now talks about fake news, he's talking about anything he doesn't like, or especially anything that puts him in a bad light. You reach for an expression like that when it's already out there, and because people sort of have it in the back of their mind, and he's glommed onto it because it's already kind of out in the public, and people are already sort of kind of aware of what fake news is. And as he said, it's been recently is people. I mean, they found this group of teenagers in literally Macedonia who get online and make this stuff up, and they're just making stuff up. And at first, it was just kind of a lark, but you get on with Google Ads, and you just kind of put stuff on top of stuff, and every time somebody comes to your site or links to your site, you get money, because while they're at your site, they also looked at these other people's ads, and the people who place the ads pay money, goes through Google, and it goes to them. And they were realizing that the more outrageous they got and the stranger the news they made up, the more clicks they got, and they got more response. The more they said things that we would consider far right wing, saying things about Black Lives Matter, saying things about Hillary Clinton, saying things, and that just they didn't have any partisan interest in it. They just did the ones that got them the most response, that got mm-hmm. them the most clicks, and that tended to be that. I mean, fake news goes at least back to, you know, when the Norse explorers called what should have been Greenland Iceland and called what should have been Iceland Greenland to tell the people who were coming after them where to settle and to keep the nice place for themselves. And then probably the most recent thing is also when we started believing that vaccinations caused autism or other ailments. Somebody put that out in The Lancet, you know, a very high respected medical journal, and they've since retracted it and they won't let him publish anymore. But once that's out there, people glom onto that and repeat it and share it online, and it just takes on a life of its own.
Ben Winslow just returned from southern Utah, where he was on the scene of the shooter's house. Is that right?
Yes, in Mesquite, yeah.
Any fake news outlets there?
No, but there was a lot of gossip and a lot of people who had heard things and believed things, and there's different definitions of fake news. There is definitely information that is intentionally propagated to mislead, misdirect, or undermine. There's also the definition of fake news, which is, I just don't like what you're saying, or it conflicts with my worldview. And so we saw a little bit of all those things. Some people were saying, well, we had heard that the suspected gunman had converted to ISIS. Meanwhile, the FBI is standing in front of a bank of cameras in Las Vegas saying there is no proof to this whatsoever that we have at this point that suggests that at all. We were hearing from people that there were other shootings at other casinos. So you had the shooting at the Mandalay Bay. People were saying, well, we heard that there was a shooting also at the Bellagio, that there was a shooting at the MGM, that all the casinos were under attack. I mean, these things, sometimes it's a version of the telephone game. I tell you something, and then you repeat it, and then by the time it gets around, it's a different version, which is why we spend a lot of time chasing rumors, I do, and trying to verify what is fact, what is what you have a witness who can back up, because there's a lot of gossip, there's a lot of rumors, there's a lot of innuendo, but what you need is hard facts, and at least from my perspective, that's, you know, we heard a lot of it, we saw a lot of it. And you know, we go out to things, and occasionally we are called fake news. You know, it becomes that catchphrase, and so again, there's really two different definitions of it that have kind of emerged now, of what it is.
And Marcia, you're on the front lines of studying what all this is, especially in social media. What are you seeing?
I think the prior panelists have made the distinction between fake news that's something that is fabricated versus fake news that's something that just the person hearing it doesn't like it, so they think it's fake. But another thing that I hear sometimes is the idea that journalists simply are not truthful. And when I teach writing, I teach that writing is about choices. And journalists make choices, and journalism is about description. And so journalists are making choices in how they describe things, the words they're going to choose, the details that they're going to use to tell a story. And I think maybe there's not enough understanding of the standards that journalists use in selecting those details or in deciding what facts, what sources, or what material they're going to use to tell a story. And there's also a matter of vocabulary. What kind of words are you going to use to tell a story? Those create an impression. So I think sometimes people might disagree with the choices the journalists make, and it gives them maybe an idea that the journalist is not being truthful. And I'm not sure what could be done about that other than to have people understand a little bit better maybe the ethical standards that journalists hold themselves to.
John Mejia, what's fake news to you?
The term fake news makes me very nervous because you hear politicians saying that, and then what's the next step? well, maybe there should be some sort of governmental limitation. And to me, that starts us down a path that makes me very nervous. I mean, I understand that people are concerned, and I think it's a valid concern, that, you know, the media is supposed to be giving accurate information. But, you know, I feel when we start putting these labels, fake, you know, made up, and then, well, what's the next step? And that's what I always watch for, like, okay, is the next step a constitutional convention that starts changing the way we understand the First Amendment? That would make me very nervous. And so, you know, I think that those are great definitions of fake news, but my concern is what's the next step?
Robert Hubert, sounds like fake news is a weapon to you.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a tool. It's a tool for, you know, for good and bad, right? Everybody wants to achieve an effect, whether you're pro some cause or detractor from a cause, you have tools available to you. So, you know, as an example, if you didn't like the wind turbines implemented out at Spanish Fork, you know, before they went in, you could have started a lawsuit, you could have protested. There's lots of things you could do. Fake news is also a tool that's used to shape and form public opinion. So from a military perspective, you know, we have tools available to us, which is social and economic, boots on the ground, steel on target. It's almost like military deception. It's another tool available to you to form or shape an effect that you want to achieve.
Interesting comments, interesting insight. Ben, how has fake news changed how you do your job?
A number of different ways. It you do have to be careful because everybody seems to, how people get their news is changing. People get the news from a lot of social media sources. And for us, there's a lot more of a challenge to make sure that, and it's a reminder to vet things. When we get a tip or we get something said to us that somebody said they saw this on Facebook or something, you'll hear on social media occasionally pics or it didn't happen. If you've ever heard that on Twitter and things like that, it's one way of trying to verify. But we also have to verify that the picture is authentic. We have to verify that whatever somebody posted on social media really happened, that we have to really talk to the person, or it's just more of an encouragement to vet that is how it's impacting us. A good reminder that way. You know, and then there's just also the, in the current climate, you have to have a little bit of a thicker skin. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've been called fake news because I've written something that somebody just disagrees with. They don't like the facts, or it has challenged what they believe in. And, you know, my job is to report the news. And, if it challenges what you believe, then I guess it does. But, you know, and that just seems to be kind of a casual throwback or a casual insult to hurl lately. So, you know, you just had to kind of shrug it off and move on in that respect, too.
George, has it changed the discussion at the Salt Lake Tribune about how you guys go about doing your reporting?
I would think not, really. I mean, I do think the internet has changed how we do things. The internet has made it such a way that it's easier to find out information. It's easier for the newspaper to find out information. It's easier for our readers to find out information, which can mean they don't need us, or it can mean they can check up on us. And in an ideal world, all that would build to deeper understanding, and it would build to the facts, because we would know that if we covered a city council meeting or a legislative hearing or something like that, that our readers have the ability, if they choose, to check up on us and listen to the streaming audio of the legislative hearing, watch the city council meeting live online. They don't have to go there. They can watch it later. They can read the Supreme Court opinion. They can read the bill. So they can check up on us and see if we have accurately or fairly reported what's happening. And I think that's good, because it kind of keeps us on our toes and makes us think, you know, we can't just throw stuff out there. I mean, I would argue that we didn't, but we know now that, you know, they can check up. And so we just admit that, and we say, not only that, we're going to help you. We put links in our stories. We link to the bill. We link to the Supreme Court opinion. We link to the transcript of the presidential news conference. So if you've read the article, and either you're not sure you got what you want to get, or you're just, you know, still hungry, you can click through and read all the details. And I think in overall that helps. Everybody has the means to check up on what we said, to get more details, to get different points of view, to get original sources instead of sources that we pick up and go through us. But it's always judgment. I mean, when you start out as a reporter and you cover a city council meeting, you don't report everything the city council did in the order they did it. You make a judgment as to what was the important thing that they did, and you write about that first. And then if you have space, you throw in a few other things. So it's always a judgment involved, even if your goal is accuracy and truth.
Marcia, I have to admit, I bristled a little bit when you described journalism as description, because I always view journalism, good journalism, as the reporting of the facts. A description sounds subjective to me.
I think you're right about that. I would never want to back away from the idea that there are facts that can be verified. But I think there's also, as we were talking about, there's also judgment that comes into it. And I have been that reporter that sat in the city council meeting and decided what was important. What do my readers want to know about this city council meeting? What is interesting about it? And how am I going to get that across to the reader? What details am I going to use about what was said?
John Mejia, should journalists be like any other profession, maybe like any other profession, where we have to go through a certain education process and tests and gulp licensing by the government to prove that we are journalists who have been trained in these procedures?
I mean, that would be a choice for the industry, right? I mean, I would, if there were, I mean, like newspapers and TV stations and journalists, I mean, lawyers have a duty to be credible, lawyers have a duty to be honest, but we also have fiduciary duties to clients, we handle client money. So there's good reason to require us to be licensed because lawyers are sort of handling other people's business. But, you know, journalists, they're reporting facts, and so, you know, it's up to the market to believe them or not. So not from a governmental perspective, I don't think that the government should be requiring journalists to get licenses. But for lawyers, we definitely should be licensed.
Lawyers, journalists, as far as respectability, right? Robert Huber, how do you know what you're reading online is accurate?
Yeah, you have to go back and check the facts as best you can based on the information provided in the story. So I'll tell you, in my industry, in cybersecurity, there's an entire industry that has sprung up in the past 3 years where companies now battle brand and reputation monitoring because they have to address those issues whether they're true or not. So you think about, you know, the Equifax breach or the unfortunate incident at United Airlines where they drug the passenger off. An entire industry exists now to proactively go and try to identify articles like that. And then there's actually a team of analysts that sit behind there trying to discern fact from fiction. And usually what they look for is, like, mainstream media sources, reporters that are well known. But to the average user, most people are going to spend that amount of time to do that. And now these companies exist that essentially do that for you, and they make multi-millions of dollars a year trying to determine fact from fiction, because that immediately turns around and goes to your legal team, your public relations team, your communications team, because they have to address those issues whether there's fact in there or not.
Let's go from journalists to opinion purveyors. So, Stu, you operate KNRS, which has a lot of conservative talk show hosts on there. Who are some of the hosts that you guys broadcast?
We have Sean Hannity, Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, Rod Arquette's our local guy on Afternoon Drive. That's pretty much the stable right there.
And who are your listeners? Can you talk about the audience, the demographic, the popularity of those shows?
Yeah, it's odd that with a group of six radio stations, we have our highest rated programs are while those talk shows are on. And the demographics tend to be a little bit older, although it's morphing younger. In the advertising world, we really look at 25 to 54-year-olds. Everybody wants to reach those, every car dealer, every mortgage company. Everybody wants 25 to 54, and we do well with that. We certainly lean a little bit more male, and we do have a probably a bigger audience than most in the 55 to 74-year-old age group. And they're pretty socially aware, and they want to make their voice heard. And, you know, it's routine for us to have every line in the radio station blinking with people ready to jump on and want to talk about it. So it's a pretty active community.
You've been in the radio business a long time, and you've seen the evolution of talk show formats. Mm-hmm. What do you make of this new evolution of strong opinions?
Well, what's interesting is that, in my opinion, radio was the social media before all other social media. If there's a good article in the Tribune, there could be a letter to the editor, or maybe they try to call him. Other reporters might get some feedback, but we put feedback on the air instantly, and a listener's feedback is a big part of the content that we do. And I think right now, we're on the front lines of some of this discussion tonight, because, for example, at the radio station today, there was a story circulating that there was a second shooter in Las Vegas, and there was flashes coming from the fourth floor of the Mandalay Bay. The video got 1.1 million views in 27 hours. And the timing of that video was just about the time the shooting started. Another person had the same angle, shooting the same direction, and those flashes were there earlier in the evening. So I think some of our guys were ready to jump on the air and say, aha, I knew they were lying to us down in Las Vegas. And then we spent a little time researching it, and if we had put that out there, callers would have called in with their opinions, and we can't fact-check everybody that's there. And opinion becomes newsworthy or credible to people that are listening in that environment. I don't want to say we purposely do that, but we can always not always control what a caller says. And part of our victory in our business is having somebody yelling at their radio or pounding their fist on the dash and go, that guy is really messed up. That's kind of a victory for us. I hate to say it, but we don't want to put out misinformation. We can't control what all those listeners say.
But you like it when people get fired up.
Yeah, it's part of the deal. I think that most of the talk show hosts, no matter what side you're on, are the writers and directors and actors in a brilliant script. And I really wonder sometimes if they really, really believe everything that they're saying, or if it's for the purpose of getting ratings or firing people up. I have that suspicion. I can't prove it, but I have that suspicion.
So, Ben, I'm going to steal some of your favorite words. Keep news local. Why is that important?
Oh, my gosh, please. You all hear about buy local, right? And, I mean, it's just one of those things that keep news local, because it does matter. We are the ones in your community. We are the ones who are going to the city council meetings. We are the ones covering the legislature day in and day out. We are the ones telling you what those police lights down the street are. We are the ones telling you what your lawmakers are doing with your taxpayer dollars and how they're spending it and what they view as a priority and what you view as a priority. And so that's why I always like to argue that, because in this era of aggregation where outlets come in or websites cherry pick things and say, can you believe this, that this just happened and things, day in and day out, your local journalists are the ones who are covering the community and what's happening to you. I mean, I'm proudly a local news reporter, and I like to cover what is happening in communities, and it's important. It matters. But what we need you as a consumer to do is to support your local news. And we are not cable networks that have people screaming at each other for hours on end, and we are not tabloids that are, you know, peddling salacious gossip. We are your local news outlets that are giving you the news that at least we believe, we hope you want, that you say you want. And so, you know, we need you as news consumers to support us so that we can continue to provide this to you. A community without news I can't even imagine what it would be like.
John, you want to chime in?
Yeah, just jumping in there. I mean, and when, from a civil liberties perspective, a lot of the threats to people's civil liberties come at a local level. You know, we have affiliates in all 50 states and more for a reason. It's because state legislatures have an awful lot of power over people's everyday lives in the state where they're living. And so we employ a policy, lobbyists in all 50 states and keep an eye out, because a lot of movements to sort of make clamp down on civil liberties are purposefully done at a state level. They'll try it in one state, and if it works there, it'll start to spread. And so we have our eyes on the state legislatures, as important and interesting as Washington politics are. I want somebody like Ben at the city council meeting telling me that they're considering, something about, an ordinance about body cams. I want us to have some input in how police body cams are used. That's a local decision. That's not going to be decided by, Jeff Sessions or the people in Congress federally. Local police are going to decide that with the input of cities. So we really do need to protect our civil liberties and expand them to keep an eye on cities, on counties, on state legislatures. And so it's absolutely vital from my perspective that we have accurate news and people with eyes on those events.
Yeah, and I do think just by the nature of the beast, regardless of who's doing it, your local news sources are more likely to be trustworthy, because we know that you have independent means of verifying a lot of this, that you could go to the city council meeting, you could go to the legislative hearing, or you could talk to somebody who was. We'll see you in the grocery store. And it was saying we have to be aware of the fact that if we get it wrong by accident or spin it wrong on purpose, that's going to come back on us because we live here. If you're doing something that's across the country or across the world, you have a lot more license to be sloppy or to just outright make things up, because the people you're talking to and talking about, you'll never see them, and they'll never see you, and you get away with all kinds of stuff. And the smaller the community, the more that's true. I've been in covered city councils and school boards in towns of 8,000 people, and you better get that story right, because half the town already knows.
Okay, so here's a big question, though. Local journalism important. Is it possible for a journalist to be truly objective? And here's a scary statistic. According to the Center for Public Integrity, in this last election cycle, close to $400,000 was given to presidential campaigns of Clinton and Trump. Guess what percentage of that went to Clinton? 96%. And these are, according to federal campaign finance filings and people who identified themselves as journalists, reporters, news editors, or television news anchors. I mean, isn't the news inherently liberal, Stu?
It's not at our place, but, it's a tough thing to answer, because you start off by saying, can everybody be purely objective? It's really hard not to have some kind of a slant on a news story. And I listen to a lot of radio shows that are classified as liberal, and I hear very challenging questions being posed to both sides. But the depth and the toughness of a question can be altered, and it's a moment-by-moment decision. I personally don't believe that it's inherently liberal. I think that there is enough sources out there where you can find the point of view that you want. And I think that there's times where the news leans one way or the other just because that's what's happening in current events. So I don't personally believe it's inherently liberal. Most people would disagree with me, and that's okay.
I'm going to ask the scholar, Marcia, what do you think? Mainstream news, mostly liberal?
My personal opinion is that it's mostly center-left. That's my personal opinion. I think I have actually, in the back of the room, since I'm a teacher, I have a handout which kind of gives some ideas for curating your own personal list of sources. I think you can be your own curator. You can look for sources on the left and on the right. I kind of do that for myself. I try to look at things that I think are reputable, that have a variety of viewpoints, that are left, right, and down the middle. so that I can kind of see what different viewpoints are. And I would, when it comes to the question of are journalists completely objective, I think that's a little bit difficult to do as a human being. That's where the training comes in. And that's where journalists need to ask themselves the tough questions. And also as a consumer, you can ask yourself that question. Am I loving this news story because it confirms my biases? Hmm. Then maybe I should look into it a little bit deeper.
Robert Huber, what is a bot and how can that influence how I think? What's a bot?
Oh, a bot. So what a lot of people do to, in essence, get their fake news in the media, you've got to have traction with the media. So whether that's YouTube or Facebook, you can't just put those out there easily. It's got to have some volume of traction. So a way to easily do that is to use a bot to do that. So a bot is me compromising, you know, your computer, your watch, your phone, your home thermostat, if it's on the internet, and using that to essentially go and click, in essence, news stories that are fake news and drive volume to those stories. And quite honestly, I can buy myself with $10 buy access to a million bots tonight if I wanted to. That's how easy it is to do. And of course, there's all kinds of illicit trading of, you know, child pornography to do that type of thing, or you have other compromised sites you trade to get access to those bots. You can actually go out now. There's companies on the internet that they're bot farmers is what they call them, and you give them a credit card and you can say, hey, I want 10,000 bots, I want a million bots, I want 10 million bots, and it will just go and generate whatever traffic you want against any target set. So if that's a click to a news story that you like, whether it's fake news or real, it can just generate that volume. And of course then websites use that volume to determine which ads to place because they want to know what's popular, what are people wanting to see. So the bot's an easy way for folks to do that.
So, John Mejia, where does the First Amendment come in on this? I mean, should Twitter and Facebook and other social media sites be censoring to keep an eye out for these bots?
I mean, I think that's where we need to use great care, right? I mean, they are private industries, and so they do have the right to curate their site and curate how they display and what they choose to display. And they definitely do. I mean, they definitely use algorithms that are designed to have pop up on your news feed what they think might be interesting to you. And, you know, from what I've read, at one point they cut out the use of algorithms or of people because the people were accused of being liberal biased.
Yeah.
And then they started using an algorithm, but the algorithm started picking up a lot of fake news. And so they're kind of left in this difficult position where, okay, well, we can start using people again, and they might be able to weed out some obvious stories that are fake news, but then you might have these middle cases. And so, you know, I don't really envy them their task of trying to figure out, because they also have their reputational stake in not being, you know, in accidental purveyors of fake news. And as I said, as the owners of these sites and as private citizens, they have the right to figure out how they want to try to do that, but it's not going to be easy. And, you know, largely the phenomenon is driven by, from my perspective, people, there might be problems not with the fake news, but with readers, right? The readers of these, of Facebook and all these other sites, they might be a little bit gullible, so they're happy to click on fake news anyway because they're going to believe it no matter what Facebook says. And then there are the people who are just going to put themselves, you know, they're not looking for center, right, middle. They're just whatever they want to see, and everything else to them is fake news, and I don't see how Facebook is going to be able to fix that problem.
Yeah, Steve, go ahead.
I want to add just a short thing to that. I referenced that Colorado case of buying marijuana with food stamps. This guy got kicked off of Google. They found out what he was doing, and he started laughing again. And he said, there are literally hundreds of ad networks out there, and dozens of them called me the day after it happened, and I was back up and running in hours, maybe even minutes. So there's just an unlimited supply of page views out there. And you pour water on a fire here, and it erupts over there. There's not enough water in the world to put out all the fires that are burning in that space.
Let's go back in time for a little bit. During the first century BC, Octavian ran a campaign of misinformation against his rival Mark Antony, portraying him as a drunkard, a womanizer, and a mere puppet of the Egyptian queen Cleopatra. In 1475, a fake news story in Trent, Italy, claimed that the Jewish community had murdered a 2.5-year-old Christian infant. The story resulted in all the Jews in the city being arrested and tortured, 15 of them burned at the stake. And in the late 19th century, we know this one, Joseph Pulitzer and other yellow journalism publishers goaded the United States into the Spanish-American War, which was precipitated when the USS Maine exploded in the harbor of Havana, Cuba. George Pyle, isn't this just the same problem we've always had?
It is, and it's amplified by modern media. I mean, I've said for a long time, computers don't make mistakes. Computers amplify mistakes. Computers spread your mistake around the world at the speed of light. And, yeah, what we have now is like I said, when they marketed Iceland as Greenland and Greenland as Iceland, I'm sure that goes back to, and that, you know, that kind of undermines the movie Cleopatra. I thought that was all true. Oh, shucks. But but yeah, I mean, people will spread rumors about their enemies in order to gin up resentment. And I mean, another thing, I think Julius Caesar spread rumors that the Britons were into human sacrifice, so that justified him conquering Britain. And and even whether it was true or not, nobody cared. It just sounded like a reason to go to war, which sometimes people are just looking for. So it goes back forever. The hope is, of course, that you'll have other sources of information and you'll do some research on your own. Now, in case of Octavian, he was the government, so he had easier access to whatever means of communication there was, and it was easier for him to spread rumors all over the place. When we use the word propaganda mostly in the 20th and 21st centuries, I think we're thinking about the government, you know, the Nazi government and the Soviet government telling people just what they want them to hear so they're willing to go to war or snitch on their neighbors or whatever it is they think they want. It's been going on forever. I do think that what we kind of need to remember is the First Amendment was written by people, if you would say unbiased press to Thomas Jefferson, he would look at you like you were speaking Urdu or something. He'd never seen such a thing. Every news outlet in read by the people who wrote the First Amendment were overtly partisan and biased, and yet they wrote the First Amendment to protect that. The idea that the press is right down the middle, fair, accurate, balanced, is kind of a 20th century beast that happened after the consolidation of the news industry, and you didn't have the Republican paper and the Democratic paper in your town anymore. You just had one. It wanted to appeal to the whole town and to all the advertisers, and then the Associated Press, which wanted to sell its product to every newspaper of every description, so they had to play it down the line, to do what they could to either really play it down the line or be seen as playing it down the line, that fair and quote everybody so that your story is either balanced or, like matter and antimatter, annihilates itself. So, you know, the idea that the press just, it's just the facts, ma'am, that's a 20th century beast. And now with the internet, we're kind of falling away from it again.
But it's become more sinister now with the internet, right, Robert? Because we have foreign countries trying to influence public policy. We're a small enough group, I think, that you can share some classified information with us if you'd like.
That'd be great, yeah. Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, it's a tool. It's a tool for all nation states to go and shape opinions, especially against adversaries or effects you want to achieve in a region. And it's relatively trivial to do. We see sometimes the adversary, you know, it used to be they had bad grammar, the fact-checking was really poor if you look into it at all. And it's greatly improved over the past 2 to 3 years to where we see they actually go out to U.S.-based universities, native English speakers, and they will pay people in the English department to write papers for them. And they'll call it an opinion paper, and they'll be paid for it. But then they'll use that writing and just snap that into a fake news story. So they've advanced so much, where it used to be very relatively easy for us to identify information, disinformation like that, and be able to go after the source. And now, you know, they do work with universities to essentially create, you know, correct grammar. I mean, it's, that seems pretty simple, but it goes a long way in creating believability of the story, the credibility of the story. So we see that not only with, and I say nation states, I mean, we see that with activist groups and terrorist groups, mm-hmm. the same thing. I mean, when they're trying to shape it, it has to be more credible. So they're spending a lot more time and resources to go out and work with people, some of them being journalists as well, to go out and say, hey, you know, if you could write an opinion piece on this, and then they take the information from that and roll it into a fake news story.
Off the record, is our country behind the times? Was Russia far advanced in doing this?
No, I think you know, every country is pretty much on equal footing. The ability to rapidly grow your capability in cyber, that's been a problem for us for the past several years, is you know, countries like Iran can do that with very little money and become you know, an advanced cyber operator. And that's gone from, and I can tell you my own experience, in the past 5 years, they've gone from somebody we didn't even care about to one of the top threats we monitor now, because it's so much cheaper for them to do that than it is to build what I would call kinetic weapons.
What's their goal? What are they trying to do?
Just like everybody else, shape opinion. Shape opinion in their favor. So whether that's, you know, things like, if you look at like China and the South China Sea, they're trying to shape regional opinion there so it doesn't look like, you know, they're overtly going out and just taking over land and building its holes and dropping ships out there. They're trying to shape opinion in that region, and of course that just goes the whole way around the world. And Iran and other nation states are no different. They're just achieving the effects they want to achieve.
So just real quick, let's go down the line, and I'm going to ask you guys where you go for news. You wake up in the morning, where do you go for news, Stu Stanek?
I do a variety of podcasts. I really like audio. I always am first to KPCW, very first thing.
I didn't pay him.
Yeah. And then I really like an NPR podcast called First Thing, or it's like 10 minutes of everything that's going to be discussed today. I do a little bit of business news, and, you know, I listen to a few podcasts on the way to work, so that's how I get all my news in the morning.
George?
Well, other than Tribune, of course, and now we're sort of kind of affiliated with the Washington Post because we've bought their, we buy their columnists and we bought their content management system, so I pay a lot of attention to the Washington Post. I still think the New York Times is probably the gold standard of print and online journalism. They're also figuring out how to make money at it, which is wonderful, because for a while there was the idea that information wants to be free. Well, that's great, but you can't hire reporters and file Freedom of Information Act requests and things like that for free. You need money to back this up. NPR is wonderful. Probably the and also the BBC is probably about the best there is. I mean, you listen to these interviewers on the BBC, and they'll be interviewing the guy from Labor, and they won't let him get away with anything. Mm-hmm. They just pin him down and pin him down and pin him down, and then they talk to the conservative, and they won't let him get away with anything. They'll just pin him down and pin him down. And what about, and why did you say that? And they, you know, talk about fair. I mean, what they do is they don't trust anybody. And that can be a good example, especially when you're dealing on a global scale and you're talking with people who have nuclear weapons. It, you know, when you're covering the city council, that's not quite appropriate. You need to be more civil. But NPR, BBC, New York Times, Washington Post, probably the best.
Ben.
Where do I get my news?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, a lot of it is, there's two different ways I get my news. When I usually start up, get up in the morning, I mean, I'm checking emails that I get, Twitter, Facebook, I'm checking social media sites, seeing what is being posted. I follow a number of different online sources, left, right, center, all of those to try to, because from my perspective, I'm looking for news. I'm looking to see what is going on that I will be covering or how it impacts me. I'm also a little bit different in that I'm a hyper news consumer. I probably consume a lot more than a lot of people do. I mean, I watch local news channels, so I'll watch my own Fox 13 and I'll watch some of the others. I will watch a little bit of Fox News or CNN whenever I can, MSNBC if I can too. Again, constantly checking social media. I read the Trib, the D News, the Ogden Standard Examiner, the St. George Spectrum, local newspapers if I can, you know, the more smaller town newspapers if I can. Also, in the evening, I'm checking RSS feeds, which are just from blogs. These are notification services that you get. I get different alert systems throughout the day. My phone blows up constantly. I mean, I pretty much live on this device. And then usually in the evening, my new favorite is the BBC World Service. I watch their newscast. It's always interesting to just see how other countries view us and view what's going on. So that's kind of how I do it.
In about 4 minutes, we're going to open it up for questions. So if people want to start lining up to that microphone, feel free. Marcia, where do you go for news?
I also love podcasts. I have a whole suite of podcasts that I listen to. Podcasts produced by the Salt Lake Tribune, produced by local NPR affiliates, podcasts produced by The New Yorker, Politico I really like. I listen to 538 podcast. Trying to think of what else. When I was working as a reporter, I was on Twitter constantly trying to figure out what was going on. And those are the things that I mostly listen to. I am also an avid news consumer. Oh, The Atlantic I really love.
John.
I get about 50 tweets a day from Ben Winslow. And actually, what I really like about what Ben does is he posts as whenever there's like an original source, he'll post it. So my filing, which I spend a lot of time on, and you know, it was my baby, Ben puts it right online so everybody can see it. The press release, you know, a lot of places will quote press releases, just what they thought was interesting. He'll put the entire press release. So I appreciate that. And I really actually do try to follow, stay as local as I can too, but I'm something of a news junkie as well. So kind of everything they've said too.
And Robert Huber.
Yeah, I start out every morning with the New York Times. I don't even get out of bed. I just grab my phone, look at it, start going through the stories there, NPR on the way to work. And then beyond that, just by virtue of what I do as an intelligence member, intelligence community member, I have a bunch of other, I call them underground sharing groups that are thousands of people across the world where we just share information about the latest hacks and breaches. I mean, that's kind of my life, so I got to keep up to date with the Equifaxes and really the underground chatter, as it were, which is interesting because it's not all news. I've got to discern from what I read there, like what's news and what's not, but you'd be surprised given the people around the globe that release information that they said, hey, here's the facts of what I have, and they don't really put opinion in. It's more of a fact trading service, I guess, if you will, of saying, hey, we saw this and this is what we know about it. So I have probably, I don't know, 100 or so groups that I get via RSS feeds and emails that I have to troll through every day looking for the stuff I'm interested in.
Yeah, it's real interesting that a lot of you mentioned NPR because that is government sourced. We get about 10% of our budget as an NPR affiliate from the government. And as a journalist, that makes me feel a little weird. You know, we report on the government. I'm not necessarily comfortable taking money from the government, but we need to stay on there, so we will.